The headlines: Iran warns the European Union against blacklisting the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, saying the bloc would shoot itself in the foot by doing so. France is witnessing nationwide protests and strikes against the planned pension reform, with the transport minister warning of a hellish Thursday. And Israeli forces kill two more Palestinians and injure several others during a pre-dawn raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the Iranian foreign minister has lashed out at the European Parliament for its plan to blacklist the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as a terrorist group. Hossein Amir Abdollahian, in a phone conversation with EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell, dismissed the decision as an injudicious and inappropriate move. He said the draft resolution adopted by the bloc is, quote, sentimental, unprofessional, and harshly worded, and runs counter to political rationality and civility. He said Europe would, quote, shoot itself in the foot by blacklisting the IRGC. Borrell, in turn, echoed the Iranian foreign minister's remarks, saying the draft resolution is tainted by sentiments and simply reflects Europe's concerns. He said the resolution is non-binding. Meanwhile, Iranian lawmakers have introduced a motion that will blacklist armed forces of EU countries as terrorist entities if the EU implements its resolution. Well, for more insight on that story, we're now joined by Hakim Esavi, BDI academic and political analyst, joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also, we have journalist, author, and activist Mr. Fra Hughes, who's joining us from Belfast. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Ms. Esavi, BDI from Tehran. In your opinion, what message and what purpose at this point are the European countries following by giving this statement?
If I want to put it in one phrase, I would say that we are witnessing the Trumpification of politics in Europe. During the maybe last couple of decades, we usually witnessed the European countries playing the role of good cop and the United States playing the role of bad cop. But now we are seeing that we are approaching a situation, a point in time, that basically politics is being Trumpified, if I may use that word. I don't know if anyone has used that word before or not, but it came to my mind that this is what is happening, that the European Union is basically adopting the maximum pressure tactic of the Trump administration, for which case the Biden administration is also adopting the same tactic. And of course, that tactic hasn't been effective. You know, it has proved to be ineffective during the administration, the Trump administration. The Trump administration was the first person that made the move to blacklist the IRGC. And that was an unprecedented move on his part, because the IRGC is an official military force of a sovereign country. And, we haven't had this sort of move by any politician before. So this is, I think, what we are witnessing. And the point that, the action is non-binding shows that it is a political move, and it is mostly aimed at public opinion. It is mostly a propaganda tool pressuring the Islamic Republic. But as I said, it shows the Trumpification of politics at the scale of the European Union.
Right. Fra Hughes, same question to you. What message is Europe sending by issuing this draft resolution?
Well, I think firstly, I've read that it's illegal in international law to begin with. I think what they're doing is, it is a continuation of the propaganda against the Iranian government and the Iranian people, a continuation of the counter-revolution from 1979, where Western governments, and I'll include America and especially Britain in this, were continually 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, trying to find ways to demonize, to isolate, and to marginalize the Islamic Republic. I think also what we're looking at is, especially with the IRCG, these people are not terrorists. These people are actually fighting terrorism inside and outside of Iran, to include the wider region. They're protecting the people of Syria, and by extension, they are protecting the people of the region against ISIS and Daesh, who are the real terrorists in the region, and who are supported by the West and are supported by America. And I think also an integral part of this is they are showing continued support for the violent protests that we have witnessed in the past in Iran. And thankfully, that has been brought under control by the likes of the IRCG and other volunteer forces within Iran. So if we can stop the attacks coming from northern Iraqi Kurdistan within Iran, that would make a big difference to the peace and security, not only of Iran, but within the region. And I suppose, finally, just to echo what's already been said by my fellow commentator, this is kind of a jingoistic politics, the politics of popularism and the politics of emotion. If there is no logical or legal basis for the EU to instigate these new sanctions against the IRCG and others, what they're doing is popularizing the emotions of, oh, we think what's being done is wrong, we have to do something about this, let's send out a public global message to demonize the Iranian government and by extension the Iranian people. And I think it's very important that it's pointed out that it's illegal and non-binding, and it's just basically a wish list by the EU and the people within the EU who are determined to bring about the downfall of the Iranian government, to the not to the benefit of the people of Iran, but to the benefit of Western corporations.
Right, and staying with you, Mr. Hughes, about Iran's response, the Iranian foreign minister has warned the European Union against this action, of course, saying that the bloc would, quote, shoot itself in the foot by doing so. If you can elaborate on that for us.
Well, I suppose now they're talking about, the Iranian foreign minister is talking about retaliatory measures. So this is like tit-for-tat diplomatic spat. I believe Europe is crying out for energy. It's crying out for oil and gas because of the sanctions that they have already put on Russia when they shot themselves in the foot. So I think if they want Iran's energy kind of output to help defer costs and to help with supply issues within Europe, I think then what they're doing is completely wrong. And the other thing that I would say on top of that is that by, you know, continuing these sanctions, on one level they're sanctioning an official part of the Iranian government, and at the same time Joseph Borrell is trying to claim that the EU wants to help reinvigorate and reconstitute the JCPOA, you know, the nuclear program. So you can't do both. You can't be demonizing Iran on one side and then claiming to be a kind of neutral arbiter in the talks between America, I assume the UN, and Iran on Iran's nuclear program.
Same question to you, Ms. Saleh Bidia. I want to get your thoughts on Iran's response to this draft resolution. Iranian lawmakers have, as we know, introduced a motion that will blacklist armed forces of EU countries as terrorist entities if the EU implements this resolution.
Yes, of course, on the first level, the Iranian officials should understand this, the point that the European Union's move shows that the IRGC has been effective in what it has been pursuing. So, you know, the IRGC should continue with its fighting against terrorism. You know, that the thing that the ayah of the Quran that is written on the flag of IRGC is the strategy, the defense strategy of the military force, and that is make ready for them every aspect of power that you can. And the IRGC has been successful over the years to do that. So first and foremost, it is that the Iranian government should understand that the pressures are coming at an area of strength of the Iranian government and not an area of weakness, and that the IRGC should continue with its strategy of fighting terrorism and keeping the territorial integrity of Iran intact and strengthening the national security of the country in assisting other nations fighting terrorism, for example, the Yemenis, the Syrians, the Iraqis. The IRGC has been effective in that, and that is, I think, the reason that it is being becoming under attack. And understanding that point, we have to be vigilant in showing to the the world public what IRGC has been doing for the service and giving the service to humanity in one sense.
All right, thanks a lot, academic and political analyst Hakim Esali Bidia, joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. And also thanks to journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes, speaking to us from Belfast. And moving on, Ukraine's president has urged Germany to supply his country with more heavy weapons, criticizing Berlin for its hesitation to hand over its modern Leopard tanks to Kiev. In a virtual address to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Vladimir Zelensky said he thinks the strategy Germany has adopted is wrong. He was referring to reports that Berlin will supply Kiev with tanks only if the U.S. sends its Abrams tanks first. Washington, however, refuses to make such a delivery. It argues that it would be difficult for Kiev to operate U.S.-made tanks, and therefore it makes more sense for Germany to provide them instead. The U.S. Defense Secretary is expected to discuss the issue with his German counterpart later today. Russia has repeatedly criticized the West's military support for Ukraine, warning that the move only prolongs the war. Well, in France, public sector workers are holding nationwide strikes in opposition to the planned pension reform by the government of President Emmanuel Macron. Workers from multiple sectors, including transport, education, and energy, have joined the industrial action. The transport minister has warned of, quote, hellish Thursday for commuters, urging all those who can to work from home. Meanwhile, the interior minister reported the deployment of thousands of police forces to maintain calm. Union leaders call it the first day of mobilization in their struggle to get the pension plan dropped. The main CGT union has even threatened to cut off electricity supplies to lawmakers and billionaires. They're against the proposal to raise the minimum retirement age to 64, as well as contributions required to receive full pensions. The reform still needs to go through Parliament, where Macron lacks absolute majority, but he hopes to get it adopted with the support of conservatives. Israeli forces have killed two more Palestinians in the West Bank as the regime intensifies its deadly crackdown across the occupied territories. 25-year-old Adham Jabarin and 57-year-old Javad Belagne were fatally shot during pre-dawn raids by the regime's forces on the Jenin refugee camp. According to the Palestinian media, Belagne, teacher by profession, was shot in his home by an Israeli sniper. Several other Palestinians were also reportedly injured in the attack. Public mourning has been announced in the city of Jenin. The latest killings bring to 17 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the start of the year. More than 170 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank alone last year. And our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, told us more about the latest Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp.
And the Israeli forces raided the Jenin refugee camp to arrest Palestinians, and the Israeli military claimed that they wanted to arrest Khalid Abu Zeina. He is a senior member of the jihad movement, but they didn't find him at his home. They arrested his two sons during the operation to Jenin refugee camp. Of course, clashes took place between Palestinians, residents of the refugee camp, and the Israeli forces who usually use their arms during such operations. They opened fire at the protesters and killed two Palestinians, as you have mentioned. Palestinians had been warning that with the new Israeli regime, led by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, there would be even more aggressive policies, more crimes would be committed against the Palestinians, and not only expansion of settlements here in the occupied West Bank, annexation of land, confiscation of lands, arrest of people, killing people in cold blood.
A stampede at the entrance of a football stadium in Iraq's southern port city of Basra leaves at least two people dead and dozens injured. Local officials say at least 80 people sustained fractures and suffocation in front of the Palm Trunk Stadium. The incident happened hours before the final game between Iraq and Oman. Thousands gathered there as the country hosts the tournament, with the participation of regional Arab countries for the first time in over 40 years. Roads leading to the stadium have been closed now. The Iraqi Prime Minister and the governor of Basra are also set to hold an emergency meeting. Earlier, an Interior Ministry spokesman had warned fans to avoid the stadium and watch the match on giant screens outside the venue. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's government has proposed an amendment to the anti-protest bill, urging lawmakers to give more powers to police to clamp down on protest rallies. The legislation is proposed amid the government's fear of more strikes and demonstrations over the cost of living crisis. The British government's move to propose a new bill to deal with protests by giving police more powers has faced strong criticism from civil rights groups. They say it's a desperate attempt to shut down any route for ordinary people to make their voices heard. Since last summer, the UK has been grappling with unprecedented strike actions over pay and working conditions. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4, 2023. Let's say you read one of the books that tells the story of one of the wives of the martyrs. I doubt you will be able to read one of these biographies without shedding tears while reading it. It is impossible. When one sees the struggles of such a woman, now the man has gone to the battlefield, but this woman is performing jihad. This jihad is obligatory on both of them. Enjoining good and forbidding evil is obligatory on both men and women. But roles have been divided. The roles are not the same. This is the view of Islam in the various fields that I have mentioned. It is both an advanced and just a view. A woman is in her exalted place and a man is in his distinguished place, both enjoying legal, intellectual, theoretical, and practical privileges contrary to West judgments, capitalist system. Of course, I'm referring to the modernized West, as I mentioned previously. Thank you.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Western capitalism is a patriarchal system. So what they attribute to Islam, which is incorrect and is the opposite of the truth, exists in their own system. Why? This viewpoint stems from the fact that in the capitalism, capital is more important than humanity. Humanity is being used to serve capital. Whoever is able to generate and accumulate more capital is more valuable. Men are more aggressive. They are stronger. The extraction of gold, jewels, and diamonds, etc. from mines was carried out by men in Africa, in the US, and in South America. It is men who have been managing the economy, trade deals, and such. Therefore, men have priority over women in capitalism. Since capital is more in the hands of men, men have a higher priority. So now that capital is supposed to determine the status of people, people are no longer the same. Naturally, they are different. As I have already mentioned, according to the capitalistic view, the male gender is naturally superior to the female gender.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Prominent pro-reform law professor in Saudi Arabia is facing the death penalty for alleged crimes including having a Twitter account and using WhatsApp to share news considered hostile to the kingdom. The ruling against Awad al-Gharni, a pro-reform law professor in Saudi Arabia, was made public in a report published by The Guardian newspaper. Gharni's son, Nasser, who fled the kingdom last year and is living in the UK, shared the details of the charges brought against his father with the British Daily. Gharni, who was arrested in September 2017, was labeled in Saudi-controlled media as a dangerous preacher, but dissidents said the 65-year-old was an important and well-regarded intellectual with a strong social media following, including 2 million Twitter followers. Public prosecutors have called for the death penalty in the case, but the court has yet to make a formal judgment. The charges against Gharni, for which he is facing the death penalty, included the law professor's admission that he used a social media account under his own name and used it at every opportunity to express his opinions. The court documents also claim that Gharni admitted participating in a WhatsApp chat and was accused of participating in videos in which he praised Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. Gharni's use of Telegram and creation of a Telegram account was also included in the allegations. Last year, Salma Al-Shahab, a Leeds PhD student and mother of two, received a 34-year sentence for having a Twitter account and for following and retweeting dissidents and activists. Another woman, Noura Al-Qahtani, was sentenced to 45 years in prison for using Twitter. The Saudi regime is also accused of ordering the 2018 brutal murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S.-Saudi citizen who used to be a vocal critic of the Saudi royalty. Khashoggi was dismembered during a visit to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The ruling against the Saudi professor comes as human rights advocates and Saudi activists have warned that authorities in Riyadh are engaged in a severe crackdown on individuals who are perceived to be critics of the Saudi regime, as the use of social media and other communications have been criminalized inside the kingdom since the beginning of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's reign in 2017. The Saudi government and state-controlled investors have recently increased their financial stake in U.S. social media platforms, including Twitter and Facebook, and entertainment companies such as Disney. Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, a Saudi investor, is the second largest investor in Twitter after Elon Musk's takeover of the social media platform. The investor was himself detained for 83 days during a so-called anti-corruption purge in 2017. Prince Al-Waleed has acknowledged that he was released after he had reached, quote, an understanding with the kingdom that was confidential and secret between me and the government. Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund, the public investment fund, has separately increased its stake in Facebook and Meta, the company that owns Facebook and WhatsApp. Jeet Basuni, the head of Middle East and North African advocacy at Reprieve, the human rights group, said Al-Gharni's case fits into a trend the group has observed of scholars and academics facing the death penalty for tweeting and expressing their views. Asked about the kingdom's investment in Facebook and Twitter, Basuni said, if it wasn't so sinister, it would be farcical. It's consistent with how they are operating under this crown prince. Since bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has arrested hundreds of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others for their political activism, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnation of the crackdown. Muslim scholars have been executed and women's rights campaigners have been put behind bars and tortured as freedom of expression, association, and belief continue to be denied by the kingdom's authorities. Over the past years, Riyadh has also redefined its anti-terrorism laws to target activism.
Israel is experiencing unprecedented mass protests. Tens of thousands of Israelis have hit the streets in several cities, including Tel Aviv, Al-Quds, and Haifa, for the second consecutive week to protest against plans by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to implement changes to Israel's legal system and weaken the Supreme Court. The demonstration presents an early challenge to Netanyahu and his far-right minister, Etmar Ben-Gvir, was ordered police to take tough action if protesters block roads or display Palestinian flags. In defiance of Ben-Gvir's call, some footage showed Palestinian flags on display. The crowd in Tel Aviv swelled to more than 80,000 people despite rainy weather there. Demonstrators, many covered by umbrellas, held signs and chanted slogans like criminal government or the end of democracy. But what were they protesting that gave way to such a large crowd to come out?
We would like to say that the current coalition in Israel would like to change the regime to make us like a dark regime in the world, and we will not accept it and will fight for this democracy.
The focus of the protests was how the new coalition cabinet, headed by Netanyahu, wants to decrease the power of the Supreme Court in its own favor. This as Netanyahu is trying to escape charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The situation has already angered Israeli officials, including the president. Herzog also warned that Israel faced, quote, a historic constitutional crisis over the contested judicial reform plan. But despite all that criticism, Netanyahu has pledged to complete legislating the reforms in a way that will correct what needs correcting, totally protect individual rights, as he claims, and restore the public's faith in the justice system that so much requires such reform. The legal changes could help Netanyahu evade eviction of corruption or even make his trial disappear entirely. For more than just 2 weeks, Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing cabinet has launched proposals to weaken the Supreme Court by giving parliament the power to overturn court decisions with a simple majority vote. It also wants to give parliament control over the appointment of judges and reduce the independence of legal advisors. Israeli opposition leaders, former attorneys general, and the president of Israel's Supreme Court have all spoken out against the plan. They said a move would cripple judicial independence, foster corruption, set back minority rights, and deprive Israel's courts of credibility that helps fend off war crimes abroad. Critics said the changes could help Netanyahu evade conviction in his corruption trial or make the trial disappear altogether. But are these protests against Netanyahu himself? Netanyahu's premiership in the past has been fraught not only with trying to escape corruption charges, but also violations like Palestinian rights, settlement construction, and other hot-button issues that exist between Palestinians and Israel. Inside Israel, the opposition against the current right-wing cabinet and Netanyahu is so high and elevated that a new movement has been created to promote and encourage Israelis to leave Israel, with a group planning to move 10,000 Israeli Jews in the first stage of its project. Meanwhile, grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime. Den of Lions is one, an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. In the meantime, the current right-wing cabinet and its far-right minister Ben-Gvir are advocating more violence against Palestinians, which would lead to more deaths, including violations like settlement buildings, changing the demographics of Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds, and other core issues. The cost of living is one other major issue protesters are angry with. After all, Israel is expensive and has one of the highest costs of living in the world. With all the crises the regime is grappling with, what seems to be on the corner for officials in Tel Aviv is what a protester said during a Saturday demonstration. "I came here to demonstrate against the anti-democratic steps of the new cabinet. This can be the start of the end of the Jewish state as we know it. Is this cabinet igniting the start of the end of Israel?" This exactly signifies what former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak expressed concern about, the survival of Israel. Barak said the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. He said throughout the Jewish history, the Jews did not rule for more than 80 years, except in the two kingdoms of David and the Hasmonean dynasty, and in both periods, their disintegration began in the 8th decade. United States, and yet again, racially motivated killings happening on a record number. The tragic death of Keenan Darnell Anderson after he was tased by police officers in Los Angeles following a car accident has sparked outrage. Anderson, 31, cousin of the co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, Patrice Cullors, died at a hospital in Santa Monica, California, after suffering a cardiac arrest following the crash on the afternoon of January 3rd in a Los Angeles neighborhood. Anderson was repeatedly tased by Los Angeles police officers and restrained following the accident. In a 13-minute body cam footage released by Los Angeles Police Department, Anderson is seen begging for help as multiple officers hold him to the ground and one officer presses his elbow along with his body weight onto his neck.
Stop it, or I'm going to tase you.
Then Anderson can be heard They're trying to George Floyd me, referring to African-American man George Floyd, who was killed at the hands of the U.S. police in May 2020 in Minneapolis, sparking racial justice protests around the world. In the footage, Anderson shouts, "They're trying to kill me," asking others for help. After the incident, paramedics arrived at the scene and took him to a hospital, where, according to the police, he went into cardiac arrest, which caused his death. Now, Patrice Cullors, who herself co-founded the Black Lives Matter movement, says her cousin was asking for help and he didn't receive it. She said he was killed, adding that nobody deserves to die in fear, panicking and scared for their life. Cullors noted her cousin was scared for his life, stressing that he spent the last 10 years witnessing a movement challenging the killing of black people. He knew what was at stake and he was trying to protect himself. Nobody was willing to protect him. Anderson's killing is the third such incident linked to the Los Angeles police in the first days of 2023. On January 2nd, police fatally shot 45-year-old Tucker Smith, and a day after, police fired on a 35-year-old Oscar Sanchez. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass has called the incidents deeply disturbing, adding that we must reduce the use of force overall, and I have absolutely no tolerance for excessive force. The latest police violence highlights alarming proportions in the U.S. in recent years, with people of color being the main targets. A 2021 study recorded 30,800 deaths from the police violence across the U.S. between 1980 and 2018, far higher than estimates offered by the National Vital Statistics System. The study said more than 55 deaths of such incidents in the U.S. from 1980 to 2018 were misclassified or unreported in official vital statistics reports. Meanwhile, according to new data released earlier this month, U.S. police killed at least 1,176 people in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record for police violence in the country since experts first started tracking the killings. The killing of Keenan Darnell Anderson takes numerous matters into the spotlight. First and foremost is how U.S. officials reacted to the incident. 31-year-old father and English teacher, who is an African-American, killed by LAPD police. The cause, cardiac arrest after being repeatedly tased by the police. Anderson is the cousin of Black Lives Matter movement Patrice Cullors, but still no major word or reaction from anyone within the establishment. Two, could this death by any means be prevented? Cullors say this was a traffic accident. Instead of treating Anderson like a potential criminal, police could have called the ambulance. If there was a policy in which traffic stops were met with unarmed professionals who come to the scene to help with whatever situation has happened, that would have prevented my cousin's death, and that would have prevented so many other deaths. The other matter that has to be taken into account is how he was killed. One officer had his elbow on Anderson's neck while he was lying down before another tased him for roughly 30 seconds straight before pausing and tasing him again for 5 more seconds. The other point is LAPD not calling it a killing. It instead calls it an in-custody death. Apart from the ambiguity of the phrase, Keene was tased to death. Everyone knows LAPD caused Keenan's death. Cullors say these types of killing and this type of force will not be interrupted unless we have courageous elected officials come forward and challenge not just the police, but also the policies. One other factor is that the incident marks the third officer-involved death in the city this year. From 1980 to 2018, more than 30,000 people have died by police violence in the United States, according to a 22 article published in The Lancet. U.S. police killing 3 people a day, and no progress since George Floyd. Based on figures released by Mapping Police Violence, police have killed roughly 1,100 people each year since 2013. In 2021, officers killed 1,136 people, one of the deadliest years on record. National data has shown that roughly 10% of the killings by police each year starts with a traffic encounter, and that 1 in 3 people killed were fleeing before lethal force was used. What about police brutality and racial bias? Why are there more cases of police brutality against African Americans or people of color than whites? By one estimate, black people are 2.5 times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. In another study, black people who were fatally shot by police seemed to be twice as likely as white people to be unarmed. Based on information from more than 2 million 911 calls in two U.S. cities, it can be concluded that white officers dispatched to black neighborhoods fired their guns five times as often as black officers dispatched for similar calls to the same neighborhoods. The Washington Post reports lawsuits to settle allegations of misconduct by more than 7,600 officers from around the country have amounted to more than $3.2 billion over the past decade. All in all, what seems to be a very high urgency is that U.S. police treatment of African Americans needs an overhaul. If not, more and more people like Keenan Darnell Anderson will fall victim to the U.S. police brutality, and officers involved killing will be sharply on the rise.
Oxfam report analyzed 1,727 attacks on Yemeni civilians since the start of 2021. The report finds that at least 839 civilians were killed and 1,775 others were wounded during this time. 87 of the deaths were caused by airstrikes alone. The aircrafts used in the attacks, over half of them British-made, used cluster bombs, the use of which is banned by international law. The rest of the killings were done through artillery strikes, missile barrages, drone attacks, landmines, road bombs, and the use of light arms. According to another report by an American think tank, The American Thinker, Saudi Arabia spends some $200 million per day on the war to hire mercenaries and maintain the arms supply. A large portion of this money goes to the UK for purchasing Typhoon and Tornado aircrafts, Paveway bombs and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles, making the UK fully complicit in the crimes committed against Yemeni civilians. As stated by the International Development Committee of the UK, given that the UK has a long history of defense exports to Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners, and considering the evidence we have heard, it seems inevitable that any violations of international humanitarian and human rights law by the coalition have involved arms supplied from the UK. These arms have also been used by the Saudi-led coalition to bomb health facilities on 19 separate instances, which constitutes war crimes. Oxfam's policy advisor Martin Butcher called on the UK government to immediately cease its arms sales to the Saudis. He also pointed out the hypocrisy of UK sanctions against Russia over alleged war crimes in Ukraine, all the while turning a blind eye to the blatant war crimes of the Saudi coalition in Yemen. Not only that, but he also pointed out to the fact that the UK government still continues to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, being its second biggest arms supplier, which will be inevitably used in the war against Yemen. Butcher also said they, the government, have really been not only arming Saudi Arabia, but also very reluctant to use their position in the Security Council to push for peace. Saudi Arabia is the biggest importer of arms in the world, second only to a country with 40 times the population. In the year 2020 alone, the kingdom imported nearly $1 billion worth of arms, the majority of which came from the U.S. This, however, does not stop the U.S. from parroting a tired narrative of pushing for peace in Yemen when they even hesitate to call it a war. This is apparent by Biden's initial pledges to end the war during his presidential campaign while still supplying arms to the kingdom to this day. Here's Timothy Lender King, U.S. Special Envoy to Yemen.
Let me begin first by reiterating our commitment, the commitment of the United States, to helping improve Yemeni lives, creating the space for Yemenis to collectively determine their own future, and to advance a durable resolution that ends the conflict in Yemen.
All the while, the weapon fragments bearing U.S. and U.K. branding paints a starkly different picture. The 6 months UN-sponsored truce that was supposed to be the grounds for longer-standing solutions was also very quickly and repeatedly violated by Saudi Arabia. This is what Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement sees as the reason for the temporary truce. The Saudi-led coalition's main goal out of the truce was to stop the Houthi Ansarullah forces from carrying out retaliatory military operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia. Moreover, the crippling sea, land, and air blockade on Yemen has created a humanitarian disaster in the country. With all options exhausted, the Ansarullah movement has now said that it will inevitably launch missile strikes deep inside Saudi and UAE territories. This comes amid reports that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is looking to find a way out of the incredibly costly Yemen war. The Lebanese Al-Akhbar newspaper wrote, "Riyadh is now showing a lot of flexibility during negotiations. It currently has no concern other than getting security guarantees that strategic facilities deep inside the country would not be hit. It has abandoned the illusion of turning Yemen into a country under its tutelage and has instead sufficed for security assurances." However, this report needs more confirmation. While the Saudi coalition has indeed failed in its attempts to strangle Yemen into submission, their aggression still caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are a true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab. Well, today in our studio we have with us Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
We are going to talk about the signs of reappearance, and one of the signs that we had been discussing in the previous series of episodes was Sufyani. We talked about his name in previous episodes, and we said that in some of the narrations, he's called as son of liberating women, in some Harb, in some Ambasa, in some Osman. But those, some of the chains were weak. And in one of the narrations we had, when some person was asking about his name, then Imam would reply that, is his name important or the action? And so we came to the conclusion that his name does not matter much. But Dr. Karimi, in a previous episode when you said that one of his titles is Son of Liberating Women, it goes back to the title of the wife of Abu Sufyan, and it shows kind of he has some lineage with them, with Abu Sufyan. So I would want you to talk about the lineage of Sufyani.
Some narrations talking about the lineage of Sufyani, and at least we have four groups of narrations, and we'll try to have a look at these four groups and hopefully to come to a conclusion based on only authentic narrations.
Yeah.
And that is one of the important points. I think I shared this point in one of the early sessions in this series, that nowadays, unfortunately, some people just refer to collections of hadith, both Shia and Sunni sources. They just try to pick one narration without analyzing the chain, without referring to the similar narrations in other sources, and just claim that this is the sign, and now we have this sign, so Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will come next week, for example. So, especially when it comes to the narrations about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and his reappearance, it is very important for the scholars to analyze the chain of the narrations. Sometimes the narrations may contradict each other, and it is in need of the learned scholars to come and to analyze the narrations. So it's not just a task and a job for all the people. It is, a very specialized task that can be done only by the learned scholars.
Okay.
So that is why we say that in our series, we just try to at least base our conclusions only on the authentic narrations.
Narrations, yeah.
Now, first of all, I share the narrations, and then I will analyze the narrations in terms of the chain.
Yeah.
According to some narrations, Sufyani is from Quraysh, the famous tribe of the Prophet,
Arab.
Peace be upon him. Yeah, the Arab tribe in Mecca. For example, in one narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam is quoted as saying, وَيَكُونُ بِالْوَادِ الْيَابِسِ عِدَّةٌ عَدِيدَ فَيَقُولُونَ لَهُ يَا هَذَا مَا يَحِلُّ لَكَ أَن تُضِيعَ الْإِسْلَامِ. In the dried land in Al-Wadi al-Yabis, we'll talk about this place, mm-hmm. There are a few people who will go to Sufyani and they will tell him that it does not behoove you to act in such a way that would damage and remove the religion of Islam. فَيَقُولُ لَسْتُ بِصَاحِبِكُمْ. Sufyani would answer that I'm not your ruler. فَيَقُولُونَ أَلَسْتَ مِنْ قُرَيْشِ. They will answer him that aren't you one of the Quraysh?
After a short break, dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. We have Dr. Karimi, and Dr. Karimi was sharing with us the narrations about the lineage of Sufyani. You said that we have some narrations which say that Sufyani is from Quraysh, and now you were giving the explanation of the narration from Imam Hadi alayhi salam, wherein he says that there will be a dried land and a few people will go to Sufyani and ask him certain questions.
Yeah. Of course, this narration is from Imam Ali alayhi salam, and the source is Aqd al-Durar, section 4, chapter 2, page 90. I will talk about the chain and the authenticity of it later after quoting all the narrations.
Narrations first,
and of course,
yeah.
This narration is not quoted in Shi'i sources. So according to this narration, he is one of the Quraysh. The second narration calls him a person from the Umayyads, from Banu Umayyah.
Okay.
In this case, we have a narration from one of the companions of Imam Ali alayhi salam called Al-Ahnaf. He says that I asked Imam Ali alayhi salam, "Min ayy qawmin as-Sufyani?" What is the tribe of Sufyani or the clan of Sufyani? Qala Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, "Huwa min Bani Umayyah." He is one of the Banu Umayyah. This is in At-Tashrifu bil-Minan, page 296, hadith number 417. Again, another Sunni source.
Okay.
According to some other narrations, Sufyani is from the lineage of Abu Sufyan. And it seems that this is one of the reasons that this person is called Sufyani.
Okay.
Because his lineage goes back to Abu Sufyan.
Okay.
There are a couple of narrations in this regard. For example, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is quoted as saying, وَهُوَ مَنْ وُلِّ عُتْبَةِ ابْنِ أَبِي سُفْيَانِ. Sufyani is one of the children, one of the offsprings of Utba, who is son of Abu Sufyan. This is in Al-Ghiba by Sheikh At-Tusi, page 444, hadith number 437. Of course, this is a Mursal narration. And some other narrations have referred to the same point, that Sufyani is from the lineage of Abu Sufyan. For example, in Muhjam Ahadith al-Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, volume 3, page 23, and of course this is another Mursal narration, Yaqdud Durar, page 72, section 4, chapter 2, and also at Tashrif al-Minan, chapter 74, hadith number 417. These are some of the sources who have mentioned that Sufyani is from the lineage of Abu Sufyan. Okay. And the fourth narration is the narration that calls him a person from the lineage of Aqilatul Akbat. That is, the woman who ate the liver of Hamza, the uncle of the Prophet, that is, Hind, the wife of Abu Sufyan. The narration is mentioned in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 317, chapter 18, hadith number 16. This narration is, of course, weak because of a certain Ubaidullah bin Musa in the chain of the narration. In another narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, يَخْرُجُ إِبْنُ أَكِلَةِ الْأَكْبَاتِ مِنَ الْوَادِ الْيَابِسِ. Ibn Akilat al-Akbat, the son of Akilat al-Akbat, that is Sufyani, will come from the dry land. This is in Kamaluddin, chapter 57, hadith number 9. Again, this narration is weak because of a certain Muhammad ibn Ali al-Kufi in the chain.
Sure. We'll discuss more after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us. Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. We have Dr. Karimi, and Dr. Karimi has been discussing a couple of narrations which talk about Sufyani, like why he is, about his lineage, basically. We have Dr. Karimi, and we're talking about the lineage of Sufyani. Dr. Karimi discussed a couple of narrations here. And Dr. Karimi, do we have more narrations? Or?
As I mentioned, there are four groups of the narrations. According to the first group, he is from Quraysh.
He's from Quraysh.
According to the second, from Banu Umayyah.
Yeah.
According to the third, from Abu Sufyan. And according to the fourth, he is from Hind, the wife of Abu Sufyan. Of course, these narrations, although apparently they are referring to different lineages, but the point is that all of them, I mean, they are contradicting each other. They may refer to the same truth because Abu Sufyan is from Quraysh and is from Banu Umayyah. And Aqilatul Akbat is his wife, I mean, Hind.
Okay.
So all these narrations are referring to the fact that Sufyani is from Abu Sufyan and Hind.
Yeah.
He is one of the offspring of this couple, and of course these people
so
are
you're
from
trying
Quraysh.
To say that apparently these narrations do contradict with each other, but when we see have a deep look at them, he is from Abu Sufyan and Hind.
Exactly. Now this is based on the narrations without analyzing the chain. Now we want to answer this question, what
by
is the lineage of Sufyani based on authentic narrations.
Okay.
The point is that a couple of the narrations that I shared, they were quoted just by Sunni sources, and we cannot refer to them as authentic sources and authentic narrations, like the narrations from Iqdud Durar or At-Tashrifu Bil-Minan. There are only three narrations that we quoted from Shia sources. The chain of all these three narrations are weak.
Yeah.
Now, this is one point. So we do not have even one authentic narration that talk about the lineage of Sufyani. This is one point. The second point is that in the past, in the history of Islam, we have had some people from the lineage of Abu Sufyan, I mean from his offsprings, who have claimed that they are the promised Sufyani, or other people, they have called them as the promised Sufyani. So according to some scholars, it might be that the same people have forged some narrations to claim that Sufyani is from Abu Sufyan, just to prove that they are the promised Sufyani, or other people have claimed that these are the promised Sufyani. So that is why they may have tried to, I mean, deceive a group of people, for example, the enemies of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So the conclusion of all these points is that when it comes to the lineage